December 11, 2012, Mayapur, India, Nectar of Devotion, Class 14. So looking now at Chapter 9. Two things I wanted to focus on in Chapter 9. First is blasphemy. So generally the devotee is very tolerant. Should be tolerant. Tolerance meaning that if you criticize me, that I don't defend myself. I'll let Krishna defend me if he wants to. Trying to reduce our eating, sleeping, mating, and defending business, so... If someone comes and says you're a fool, you can just say, yeah, it's true. It's quite an interesting exercise to try to cut down on self-defense. Give it a try. It's very liberating. By the way, how do you feel when other people defend themselves? Think about it. Are you convinced when other people defend themselves? Not usually, yeah. Right, so why do we do it? Kind of silly, huh? So the devotee doesn't really put much time or energy into defending themselves. I mean, you would want to defend yourself if somebody else would be harmed by you not doing so. If someone's accusing you of something that you didn't really do, and it's very, very, very important for the truth to be known or someone else would be harmed, then you might defend yourself. But generally speaking, the devotee does not defend themselves. I mean, of course, if someone's trying to kill you, then you can, you know, self-defense is not sinful. Someone trying to kill you, steal something from you, rape you, whatever, you know, self-defense is normal and natural. There's nothing wrong with that. But in general, we're very tolerant. If people criticize us, people say things about us, true, untrue, whatever, you know, let them say whatever they want to say. What does it matter? Really, what does it matter? And... at the same time, we're not like that when devotees and Krishna are criticized. So if Krishna is criticized, if devotees are criticized, then we take very strong action. So most people in this world are the opposite. If other people are criticized, they're quiet. They don't want to get involved. And if they're criticized, they make a big stink. No, devotees are the opposite. I mean, here it talks about being willing to give up your life rather than hear blasphemy. So that it's taken that. It's not that anybody should actually do that. We should not stay around people who are blaspheming Krishna or his devotees. Remember, the Uttamadhikari is free from the propensity to criticize others. So criticism, it's basically defending and attacking. We should really try to give up this animal business of defending and attacking, defending and attacking, defending and attacking. Especially if the only thing we're defending is our false ego. What a silly thing to defend. The thing that's causing us all of our trouble, and we're defending it. But we don't tolerate any insult. So it may seem contradictory, the devotee's so humble, and yet they'll become like fire if Krishna's offended. And you'd see Prabhupada sometimes doing this. Sometimes Prabhupada would be at a gathering where some Mayavadi would get up and start blaspheming Krishna, and Prabhupada would start a kirtan in the middle of the other person's speech. Which, you know, is rude. Isn't it? Somebody else is speaking, and all of a sudden you start singing.
It's like going la, 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 la.
Exactly. So we would think, well, that's not, you know, a sadhu shouldn't behave like that. So a sadhu will tolerate any criticism of themselves, but they will not tolerate criticism of Krishna. Of course, there are some times when we don't want to tolerate criticism of ourselves. If there's going to be some harm to the preaching or to Krishna or to somebody else, there are some times. I gave an example in my class today of the town president who told my mother that he wasn't qualified. You know, she visited me in the temple. This is a month after I joined, and she said to the town president, so what are your qualifications for being temple? I mean, here's this guy in charge of her daughter's life, you know. So she wanted to know, what are your qualifications to be a town president? And she's coming from a world where if you ask somebody, what are your qualifications, they tell you. they say, well, I have an MBA from Harvard, and right? I have 3 years managerial experience. That's the place she was coming from. And she asked him, what are your qualifications? And he said, I don't have any. And the result of that was that she was very critical of the Hare Krishna movement for about 10 years. You know, I mean, I'm sure there were other reasons too, but she would always use that one. You know, your temple presidents don't have any qualifications. So there are some times when we should not allow people to criticize us. In certain situations like that, where criticisms of us are going to end up being criticisms of Srila Prabhupada or criticisms of Krishna, where they're not really criticizing us at all. Do you understand what I'm saying? Where it's not really about you, it's really about Krishna. Well, you people, you're just like this and like this, and they're not really talking about you. They're really talking about devotees, so that's something else. But generally, we are willing to violate etiquette, and we are willing to be like fire, and we are willing to be intolerant if God's being blasphemed. Yes?
I just wanted to ask, what's the difference between like blaspheming someone and kind of working through a problem? Like, say, a devotee is revealing their mind and heart to another devotee because they might be having a particular problem that they need to speak about for their own kind of emotional, mental well-being. What is the difference between criticizing and where's the line between blaspheming and...
Well, I'm going to ask you, can you feel it? Can you feel it? Does it feel different to you? Now, if you do it all the time, you won't notice. If you're constantly criticizing and blaspheming others, you won't notice it anymore. But if you're trying your best to avoid criticism and blasphemy, do you notice when things are on one side of the line and when they aren't? Does it feel different to you?
The person on the other side doesn't always feel it, though.
No, but if you're doing it, you would feel it. I think you notice it when you hear it. Do you notice it feels different? And you notice when you say it or when you think it? Do you notice? So if you don't, try to abstain from all criticism and blasphemy completely, and then you'll become sensitized to it. And chant good japa. And you'll become sensitized to the line. Basically, the line is envy. You know, when we're criticizing someone to show that we're better than they are. And of course, out and out blasphemy means you're saying something false. Which in the Bible it says that's the of the seven deadly sins that God hates, the one he despises is bearing false witness. So to say something untrue about somebody else to get them in trouble and make them look bad.
So if it is something that is true that they might be doing, that, like...
Well, are you delighting in it?
Like, it might be criticism, but not necessarily in the blasphemy.
Okay, out and out blasphemy is something that's just not even true. But also anything where you have a mood to overlord or to delight. I'm delighting that I'm so much better than others. I mean, look, all of us conditioned souls do that to some extent a lot, in our mind at least. Right? Yes? That in our mind we're thinking, oh, look at that, oh, look at that. That's a really lousy way to feel good about yourself. You know, you feel good about yourself because you're part and parcel of Krishna and he loves you. Not because you're neater with how you put on your sari or something. It's 3 o'clock and you have all your rounds done and they don't, or whatever it is that you're overlording somebody. But you should become sensitized so you can feel when it's yucky. You should sensitize yourself and clean yourself. Yeah.
What if you're in a situation where you can't get out of that place? Like, let's say you're working under authorities who are basically sometimes, between authorities, they sometimes may voice their dissatisfaction with the inefficiency of another authority. But because you're serving under them, you can't leave the service.
Prabhupada says the highest principle is to save others, and higher than that is to save yourself. You've got to save yourself. If you can't fix the situation, you either have to fix the situation or you have to get out. Now, if you absolutely can't get out, if you're in prison, then you're not going to be held responsible. you know, Prahlad had to deal with his father. He couldn't get out. He was stuck. So if you're actually chained up in prison and you actually can't get out, you're not going to be held responsible. But if you're not in prison, you either have to be able to fix the situation or you have to get out of the situation. If you want to know what will ruin your spiritual progress the fastest, it's that. It acts like a crazy elephant. We don't see very many crazy elephants, because we don't see very many elephants. But, you know, most animals, the female goes through heat where they become fertile. But with elephants, the male also does. It's called must. So male elephants go through a time of sexual craziness. And it's random. It's not at a particular time like it is for females. And when they do that, they go crazy. If they were trained elephants, they forget all their training. They'll even attack their trainer. Elephants don't usually do that. And when elephants going through must, all the other male elephants will get out of the way. I mean, the biologist's theory is this allows the young elephants a chance to mate. Otherwise, only the old bull elephants will mate with all the females. But I don't know if any other animal, I think there's one other animal, where the male has a time like that. But people who lived in societies where there were elephants around, and where there were wild elephants, what they do with tamed elephants is as soon as they see the male elephant going into must, they don't let him have anything to eat or drink. And it makes it go away. Don't give him any food or water for a while. It makes it go away. But these crazy elephants, they would destroy everything. You know, if there was an elephant in must, everybody got out of the way. I mean, even the other male elephants got out. Everybody got out of the way. They would destroy everything. So blaspheming devotees is compared to a mad elephant. Again, I don't know if we relate to that analogy because I'm sure none of us have ever seen a mad elephant. There just aren't very many anymore. There aren't very many wild elephants and we don't see them. But they just destroy everything. So far, far better. The most important thing is to save yourself. So try to fix the situation. If you can't fix the situation, you need to get out. Yes?
But otherwise, is it okay to, like if you do have a concern and you need to discuss something, because especially when you're new, there's all these things that keep coming up.
After all, that doesn't happen anymore.
I'm sure it does, but I feel like every 5 seconds I'm like, oh my god, this happened, and blah, blah, blah. And you have to say who it is, because otherwise...
Well, if it's every 5 seconds, then maybe you need to change what you're paying attention to.
No, sorry, I don't mean that literally, but...
Well, sometimes.
At least once a week, something.
That's just normal. Then you have to decide, is this my service? Is it my service? I'm a servant. I have my area of service. Is this in my area of service? If it's in my area of service, then I should have a way to take care of it. If it's not in my area of service, then I have to decide whether or not it's an emergency. Remember, we talked about three kinds of duties. Is this an emergency? In an emergency, you can walk out of the boundaries of your area of service and do somebody else's service. Then you better decide. You better make sure it's an emergency. And then if it's an emergency, you still go through the proper channels and you do it without envy, without feeling you're better than somebody else. I was in the temple the other day and I saw this brahmachari hit a child to force him to offer obeisances. So I consider that an emergency. And I mean, he was wearing saffron, but still I walked up to him, I said, is that your son? He says, no. So I got his name and I went to somebody on the CPT and I said, this brahmachari just hit this boy to force him to offer obeisances. And then I let go of it. I have no idea what happened after. That's not my business.
I guess I'm more talking about to like an equal or maybe like a senior devotee just to express yourself rather than like you're doing something about it.
We don't have to fix everything, you know, thank God. And you can't anyway. It won't work. Anyway, my answer to you, you can do whatever you like with my answer, but my answer to you is, first of all, see, is this my service? Is it in my area of service? As part of practical humility, we should give a class, practical humility, not theoretical humility, practical humility. So, is this my area of service? Yes. Well, how do you know? Who gave it to you as your area of service? Who assigned it to you? You just decided it's your area of service? I mean, I had one person who over Facebook was sending me critical things about different leaders in ISKCON. And I wrote to him and I said, who gave you this service? Who told you that you're the one that is supposed to be looking at these people and criticizing them? I said, how do you know it's your service? Well, it is. I said, how? Who gave it to you as your service? What authority gave this to you? How do you know this is your service? So, you know, see, what I'm a servant. Servant means I have my area. As I said, we work for Krishna's company. I have my area in the company that I'm in charge of, and I frankly have things that I'm not in charge of. I have things that I have just no business about at all. It's just not my business. This isn't. And if I try to get involved in my experience, because I have tried to get involved in the past in things that weren't my business, the only thing I accomplish is I damage myself. I change nothing. Nobody listens to me. Nobody changes anything. And I just get irritated and I forget Krishna. All of a sudden, the beautiful blue cowherd boy playing his flute is out of my consciousness. So that's my own personal practical experience, that if I try to fix something that's not my business and it's not an emergency, and don't make everything an emergency. Everything's not an, everything you see wrong that's out of your area of service, is then you have no area of service again. Does that make sense to everybody? If I say this is my area of service, but anything out of my area of service that I see wrong is an emergency. It should be a real emergency. And then if it's a real emergency, you go to the proper authority. You know, I saw somebody hurting a child, I went to the CPT. The other day I saw one of the workers pull a live, healthy Tulsi out of the ground. So I went to Jnanivas about it. I said, and the first thing I said is, are you the right person to talk to? I said, am I going to the right authority? And he said, well, yeah, you can consider Tulsi's a deity, so I guess I'm the right person. So I told him, and he said, yeah, we have this problem sometime with the workers. I said, because Tulsi grows everywhere here, and sometimes if she's in the way of what they want to do, they just pull her out of the ground. And then I left it. It wasn't my business anymore. Does that make sense to everybody? If you want to be happy. If you don't want to be happy, that's something else. But if you want to be happy, and if you don't want mad elephants destroying your garden. And I have seen people, and I've been one of those people sometimes, who think that, you know, they're God. Or maybe I'm one of those people all the time. And that they have to fix everything in the world. And you know, I can't. I can't even fix everything with me. Can any of you here fix everything with yourself? And think how hard it is to fix something with yourself. Do you have something with yourself you'd really, really, really like to fix? And maybe you've been working on it for years, and you don't get it fixed, and it's you? So if I can't fix some of the things in me after trying for years and years and years and years and years and years, and I really want to fix them, then who am I to say that I can fix everything else and everybody else? And I've become a much happier person by narrowing and narrowing and narrowing and narrowing my circle of who and what I'm responsible for other than me. And it's made me a very happy person. Now, if you're a manager, and I was a manager in this country for 18 years, if you're a manager, then you have a bigger circle that you're responsible for, and then that's your duty. If you're a parent, if you're a teacher, if you're a temple president, you're a temple commander, you're a guru, then you're obligated to look at people's faults. I mean, like all of you are going to email me your essays. And if I just go, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's nice. That's not my job. My job is to say, this is good, this is bad. That's my job, or I'm an editor for Back to God Ed, and I've got to look at an article and say, this is a bunch of bogus nonsense. Hopefully you don't always say it like that to the author, but the point is we've got to be able to say that's my service. But I'm not in charge of what gets published in other ISKCON publications. Now again, if I see something, I can't, and I feel it's an emergency, I can go to the person who's in charge. And then I have to decide, is this an emergency? Are the people likely to listen to me? The answer to that question is generally no. And if they're not likely to listen to me, and it's not an emergency, and it's not my service, then you know what? I'm going to let Krishna deal with it.
I guess I'm more talking about if you are the kid that's being hit over the head for not paying the basis, can you then go to someone and say,
definitely.
And because you're upset about it, so you need to express that.
Definitely. Now, if people keep hitting you over the head because you're not paying obeisances, you probably need to change something in your life. So if that's, you know, if that's really happening to you frequently, you need to change something, either internally or externally in your life. So there's something wrong either with your external situation or your internal consciousness if that keeps happening to you frequently. I mean, it happens to everybody sometimes. But if it's happening to you very, very frequently... That makes sense? I mean, it happens to everybody sometimes. Right? Everybody, all of us, sometimes people treat us badly and unjustly and unfairly and hurtfully and etc. But if it's a regular thing, if it's happening, you know, every half an hour or 3, 4, 5 times a week, and then you need to change something. So either you're doing something really radically wrong, or you're in the wrong situation, or both, or something. Yeah.
How do we deal with if your friends and seniors or peers are not expressing their minds to you like frequently, like that? You don't want to step out of the situation because you know your friends or your value their association.
Highest principle is to save yourself. Who's your shelter? What do you want? What price are you willing to pay? Only you can decide the answer to that question. Are you going to offend Krishna because these people are your shelter and you're more concerned with what they think of you than what Krishna thinks of you? Only you can decide that. You've got to decide. Who am I? Therefore we say only Krishna. It's Uttam Bhakti is just for Krishna. It has to be ultimately Krishna. And if, you know, your friends and this and that and the other thing are ruining your relationship with Krishna, then, you know, you've got to decide, what am I going to do? What price am I going to pay? Now, it might not mean that you never see those people again, but you might want to adjust your relationship with them. If people realize that there's things that you never want to talk about and you don't respond to and you walk away, generally they'll stop talking about it. Some people won't, and then maybe those people, you need to sever your relationship with them. I had somebody in my life who insisted on really blaspheming devotees, and I said, I don't want to hear this. I'm happy to deal with other things with you, but no, I'm sorry, I don't want to hear this. Talk about it with someone else. And then it would happen again, and I'd say the same thing. It would happen again. Finally, I just had to actually block the person in my life. I had to block their emails, and I had to just block them out of my life. How many times am I going to say, I don't want to hear these criticisms about these other people that I have no control over and I have nothing to do with, and it's just nothing to do with me, and I don't want to hear it? Most of the time I find if I say that, people will respect it maybe after 2 or 3 times, or maybe 5 times or 10 times. And sometimes you're deciding, what do I do? Do I walk away from this person, or is it solvable? This person on Facebook who kept criticizing, now he doesn't do it with me anymore. You know, I finally just kept saying, I don't want to hear this. I'm sorry, it's not my service, Prabhu. I'm really sorry, this is not my service. This is nothing to do with me. I can't do anything about this. You know, you need to talk to someone else about it. And that would be all I would say. Just, you know, sorry, this is not my service. And then after a while, he gives up because there's no reciprocation. And I don't go like, you're that. And then that's a kind of reciprocation too. But I just, you know, just nothing. You find usually that's enough. Sometimes I have to cut a relationship. Not often, but sometimes. Sometimes I just have to say, this is a person I'm not going to associate with. I've also had some experience that, you know, sometimes I'm the one who has to change. I had somebody who I felt was very offensive and very disrespectful, and I was avoiding this person, and I realized that I needed to change my attitude towards this person, and as soon as I changed my attitude, they stopped doing it. And I don't want to say any more than that because it's being recorded, but it was a very fascinating experience. I think I've only had one experience like that, but it was really interesting. That somehow when I started to really like the person and really appreciate the person, they stopped criticizing other people to me. Interesting. Okay, other thing I wanted to talk about in this chapter. Is submission, and I've written some stuff on the board. This is a kind of offering of prayers, actually, although it's entitled submission. And here the prayers are put into three categories: very feeling prayers, very humble prayers, and prayers desiring some perfection. And the example given of very feeling prayers is, "My Lord," this is on page 81, "I know that young girls have natural affection for young boys, and the young boys have natural affection for young girls. I am praying at your lotus feet that my mind may become attracted unto you in the same spontaneous way." Actually, Prabhupada uses sexual interest often as an analogy for bhakti. In fact, he uses it when talking about the child's propensity to walk and sadhana awakening our propensity for bhakti like that. He also uses sex desire like that. He says, you know, when a person becomes of age, then seeing an attractive member of the opposite sex awakens their desire. But if they didn't have any inherent sexual desire, it wouldn't happen. It's not just seeing someone. There's something within them that's natural within them that comes alive. So this is that prayer, that just like a young boy and a young girl, you don't have to train them. You don't have to, you know, show them romantic movies. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything. At a certain age, boys and girls naturally become attracted to each other. So the devotee is saying, "Krishna, I want my attraction to you to be natural and spontaneous somehow. I want to just see you and immediately say, yes, I love you." The next kind of prayer is the example given, "There is no sinful living entity who is more of a sinner than myself, nor is there a greater offender than myself. I am so greatly sinful and offensive that when I come to confess my sinful activities before you, I am ashamed." And here Prabhupada also explains that one shouldn't confess sins and then go on sinning and sinning. And he also says that one should be ashamed. We shouldn't have a cavalier attitude about our offenses and our sins. "Oh yeah, yeah, I've done so many sinful things and so many offenses sin." Oh, we're offending a person. We're offending the person that we want to love. Now, I've often wondered about these kind of prayers. It's like, I'm the most sinful of all sinful people? You know, how is that? I mean, I would think the most sinful of all sinful people is like a serial killer, torture, rapist, cannibal, you know, arsonist, whatever. That to me is the most sinful of all sinful sinfuls. And it's like, I haven't done anything like that. At least not that I can remember in any life. Maybe I had a life sometime where I was a torturer or something, but I don't remember that. I don't feel like that. I've never committed any major crime in my life. So how could I come before, I assume that's true of everybody here? Anybody here a murderer? Or maybe you stole a candy bar when you were a kid or something, but you know. Murderer, major thief, or something like that? No. Anybody here but a torturer? You work for some sort of dictatorship and you tortured people and pulled out their fingernails? No. So how can one pray, "I am the most sinful of all sinners"? How is that real? What does that mean? So this is something that I've meditated on for decades. I'm kind of an odd person when I think about it, I think. And the conclusion that I came to is that turning away from Krishna is the most sinful thing anybody can do. These other things are really just symptoms. Like Prabhupada says, everyone's a thief whether you steal a diamond or a cucumber. You know, whenever I take pleasure in someone else's pain, whenever I take pleasure in someone else's problems, oh, well, I'm not like that. Oh, I wouldn't do that. You know, that in quantity that may be very different from taking pleasure in pulling out somebody's fingernails, but the mood is very similar. That I'm getting my happiness from someone else's unhappiness. I'm feeling good about myself at someone else's expense. And basically, I've turned my back on the nicest, most loving, most kind, most giving, faultless person for no reason other than my own envy. And that when one sees that, one feels like the lowest of the low, and that nobody could be lower than them. Of course, you can say all conditioned souls are that low, but the person is feeling this. There's nothing that could be lower than that. And they're not really looking at sins in some sort of legalistic, you know, crime roster. Sort of, you had to be, you know, an experimenter in the concentration camps in Germany or something. They're not thinking like that. They're thinking like, and again, they're understanding sin as anything that's an offense to Krishna, and anything that's going against truth. They're not understanding just sin as breaking specific laws, but as a mood of turning against our very self. So that mood is necessary. One has to have some humility to advance. And the last kind, just one second, the last kind of prayer is for advanced devotees, for people on the platform of Raghunuga Bhakti and higher, and that is when somebody has realized or begun to realize as Prabhupada says, in 81, when one realizes, he says, this desiring some perfectional stage in spiritual life is not sense gratification. So if you say, I want to serve you like this, I want to serve, that's not sense gratification, it's about service. When one realizes something of his constitutional relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is a prayer for people who have realized something, they haven't necessarily realized everything. But when they've begun to realize, I am a gopi, I am a cowherd boy, I am this, I am that, then they start praying for further realization and they start praying for a specific service. So that kind of prayer is a more advanced stage, and that is, Krishna, I want to fan you, I want to offer you sandalwood pulp, you know, like that. Of course, we can pray like that in relationship to our service now. In this body, we can say, you know, Radha Madhava, I'd like to make you a garland. But that's a little different from, okay, I realize something about being a cowherd boy, and I say, Krishna, please show me how to play ball with you, because I'd really like to play with you.
When you say desiring for perfection, can't we desire for perfection of the stage and then go to the next stage?
Yeah, that's the first one, though.
Oh, okay.
So the first kind of prayer is a general wanting of perfection, or wanting of going to the next stage and where I'm in. The last kind of prayer is very specific, where one is praying for something specific in one's spiritual body. So in order to do that, one has to have at least the beginning understanding of one's spiritual body. You may not have to realize it completely, so you need to realize something. And Prabhupada says that this stage comes in the stage of perfect liberation called Swarup City, where you start to realize your body. Yes?
You said about the first prayer about children... when they reach a certain age, they become lusty. But why did Krishna bother making that inbuilt? Like, if children aren't lusty in the beginning and then they reach a certain age, like, why would he do that?
Why is there such a thing as sex desire altogether? Excellent question. I have actually about an hour and a half presentation on sex desire.
Yeah, I'm trying to get hold of it.
Which, you just email me and I'll send it to you.
Okay. What's your email?
Urmila Devi Dasi, one word. @gmail.com.
Is Urmila spelled like
that? I'll write it on the board. And I can send it to you. And there's a recording on ISKCON Desire Tree. So if you go to ISKCON Desire Tree, you can get the PowerPoint and you can get the audio recording of the class. Now, what I did in Vrindavan recently is I actually gave that presentation to everybody in the VIAG and plus some other guests came, but I don't think I have time on this trip to do that. I mean, it's at least an hour and a half. And, you know, we have to arrange it, and I don't think I have any time. I think I'm kind of booked. And a real basic synopsis, because this is kind of off the topic of nectar devotion, and as you all see that I really try to stay on topic. I hope you appreciate that. You might not appreciate it if you have a question that's off topic, but I really hope that, in general, you appreciate it.
You don't have to answer it.
Well, I'll watch the clock. Basically, material sexuality is a perversion of love of God. And spiritual bodies have sexual feelings. Bhagavatam 5.25.5. There are sexual feelings in spiritual bodies. It's part of the soul. It's not that Krishna put that in material bodies. It's actually something that's part of the soul. You can read about that in Bhagavatam 5.25.5 and in Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhulila, chapter 8, text 138. In spiritual life, sexual feelings and sexual pleasure are related to uniting Radha and Krishna, to uniting Sita and Ram, and to uniting Lakshmi and Narayan. Basically, to pleasing Krishna, anukulyena. And when one pleases Krishna, Krishna's energy of pleasure is Radharani. As soon as you please Krishna, in any way, anything you do that pleases Krishna, it means you unite Krishna with his pleasure energy. And the jiva experiences original, genuine, spiritual, real sexual pleasure by doing that. And that pleasure is so much better than the material brand of it, which is why when you feel that in Krishna consciousness, you lose interest in the material because it's not very interesting by comparison. Material sex desire is I want to be the enjoyer of the pleasure energy, either by enjoying a woman or by being a woman. I want to control the pleasure energy. And I want to exploit others for my pleasure. Spiritual sexuality is I want to give. And because we're part of Krishna, when he enjoys, we enjoy. So just like, if you're sleeping, please stand up. Otherwise, I wonder if I'm boring. And then I'll feel I have to entertain you. We're part of Krishna. I mean, we experience this a little bit. If you visit a family where the husband and wife are really loving with each other, don't you also feel happy? If you visit a family where they're fighting with each other, don't you feel unhappy? When you go to the wedding of a good friend, don't you feel happy? Everyone is enjoying in their happiness. Now, if you're really part of that person, if you're actually part of Krishna, which you're part of Krishna, when he's happy, you're happy. And everyone in the spiritual world is uniting Radha and Krishna, and uniting Lakshmi Narayan, and uniting Sita and Ram, in any rasa, in any relationship with Krishna. That's the original form of our sexuality. What's the main way that we unite Krishna and his pleasure energy? By chanting. When we say Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. Which is why when you're chanting, you can feel some of that original sexual energy. Now, what happens is the essence of our rebellion against Krishna is I don't want to enjoy with you, I want to as part of you. It's kind of like if you go to a friend's wedding and you steal her husband. Just like Hanuman, he wants to unite Sita and Ram, and Ravan wants to steal Sita. Basically, we're trying to steal Radharani is basically what. We're trying to steal the pleasure energy. And that can come, again, in the form that we can try to be it or we can try to own it, you know, two different flavors of it. And you can't be happy that way. It just doesn't work. It's not how, it's like trying to be happy by putting food in your eye instead of in your mouth. Trying to be happy by watering the leaf instead of the root. It doesn't work. So this desire to be happy separate from Krishna shows up as material lust. That's how it manifests. So Krishna is very kind and very clever. He's very kind and that he made material lust pleasurable. That's a very non-envious thing to do. If somebody wants to steal something from you, you sure don't want them to enjoy what they've stolen. But Krishna allows us to enjoy what we're stealing. So that he's a just completely non-envious person. The other thing is that Krishna is very clever and that Krishna combined sexual desire with reproduction. I mean, he didn't have to do that. Again, that's another thing I thought about for a long time. Why did Krishna make it so that babies come from sex? I mean, he didn't need to. Vishramitra Muni made babies come from coconut trees. And then Lord Brahma told him to stop. So, you know, why did Krishna do that? And the answer to that is given in the Bhagavad Gita, that the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. If you want to find Krishna, if you want to find truth, you have to find sacrifice. Just like we say our Sanatana Dharma is to give, to serve. That means sacrifice. Krishna also sacrifices. Krishna tells Lord Brahma, I create, maintain, and destroy by penance only. Isn't that interesting? He's God. So Krishna is always giving, giving. Isn't he giving us like everything? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Krishna, he's an unlimited giver. He can also unlimitedly receive. Krishna can receive any amount of love that you want to give him. An ordinary jiva can't. Try loving an ordinary jiva completely. After a while, they'll back off. And they'll say, okay, you know, give me some space. But Krishna can receive unlimited love, but he also gives unlimited love. The all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. Reproduction involves, if any of you have done it, a lot of sacrifice. First of all, it involves sacrifice to the member of the opposite sex you're attracted to. That's true for both men and women. It's not just that women sacrifice for men. Men sacrifice for women. It involves a lot of sacrifice. And children involve a lot of sacrifice, right? The mothers who are here. It may be a nice kind of sacrifice most of the time, but it's still a sacrifice. And by coupling sex with sacrifice, he purifies the very thing that's the embodiment that embodies our rebellion. Now, by the way, even if you're a celibate, your sexual energy has to be mixed with sacrifice. It's not that celibates just don't have sexual energy. You can't not have sexual energy because it originally comes from the soul. It's part of us. You can't kill your sexuality. You'd be killing yourself. If you don't believe me, read 5.25.5. You have this skeptical look on your face. And Madhya Leela 8.138. She puts this sign on her forehead. I'm not sure if I believe you. You can go look it up. So you can't kill sexual desire. Renunciates are not killing sexual desire. They're bringing it to the brain.
Bring it to where?
To the brain. They're using their sexual energy for study and research and preaching. Sexual energy is the energy of connection, otherwise called yoga. It's the energy of pleasure. It's the energy of creation. Right? Anything else? Connection, creation, pleasure, life, vitality. So you can't kill those energies. Not possible. They're part of the soul. You can try it. If you try to kill it, what will you get?
Frustrated.
You're very frustrated and angry. Or you'll fall. You try to kill it, either you eventually fall down or you'll get very frustrated and angry, so you can't kill it. So anyway, what we experience as material lust is really just the twisting of prema. And Krishna has very, very cleverly made it so that in order to fulfill our material lust, we have to engage in sacrifice. And because the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice, as soon as we engage in any way to deal with lust, whether you deal with lust through marriage and children or you deal with lust, any bona fide biological way to deal with lust. Now, if you're a rascal, you'll try to deal with lust by stealing some more and having some illicit relationship and using contraceptives and killing the baby and so forth and so on. But if you honor biology, if you honor creation, then your choices are either procreation, or celibacy, both of which require sacrifice. And by that sacrifice, you touch the Supreme. And so the very thing that's pulling you away from the Supreme, Krishna arranges to pull you back to the Supreme. He's very clever. Plus, he lets you enjoy it at the same time, which is awfully kind of him. Very kind and generous. He didn't need to do that. It wasn't required. If he was envious, he wouldn't have done that. All right. Go back to our topic. Okay, those were the two things I wanted to talk about in this chapter. And I wanted to now go to the questions because I have a lot of stuff I want to talk about in the last chapter. So we have some from yesterday. It seems every day I'm doing something yesterday. Okay. If possible, please outline some Shastic references we can approach to find out why we cover our heads. Also, please kindly tell us your understanding of why we do. Okay, this is again, this is really off like nectar devotion topic. If you can please ask questions that relate to nectar devotion. Prabhupada just simply says that covering your head is a symptom of a married woman's shyness. And he says that unmarried women must not cover their heads. I don't know what his basis is. By the way, when Prabhupada says unmarried women, he doesn't mean a 45-year-old, thrice divorced person. That's not what he means. He means a virgin girl under the care of her father and mother. So, but, I mean, ISKCON policy tends to be if you're female and, like, over the age of 10, or it used to be over the age of 2, you know, then you should have your head covered. But, I mean, I can't show you the quote where Prabhupada said, if the unmarried girls, it must be open. But he just says it's a symptom of the married woman's shyness, and I have all kinds of speculations as to what that means and why, but I can't, I don't feel like telling you my speculations right now. Why can't women become gurus, siksha, or diksha for other women? They can. And men too. How does that go against vanashram? It doesn't. Wouldn't that be considered better than other single sannyasi men becoming gurus for single young women? Yes.
What? Can you read that again?
Why can't women become gurus, diksha or shiksha, for other women? They can.
But are they?
Right now in ISKCON? Shiksha, yes. No. Right now, no. But they could, yes.
Well, how's the process for them? I mean,
Shastrically or our present ISKCON system, which you want to know?
Both.
Our present ISKCON system is you have to get votes from a local 10 area council, and then you have to get votes from the GBC. That's our present ISKCON system.
So if there's enough people
That's like vote. System number 15 since 1978.
So enough people vote, and then they come, like,
it has to. You have to convene a 10-person council that consists of your local town president, local GBCs, local sannyasi, and if they vote yes, then it goes before the GBC body, and you have to get a yes vote in the form of silence from all. You can get no more. They do a no vote instead of a yes vote. So they ask anyone, does anyone vote no? And if 3 people vote no, then it has to come to the GBC body in person, and then they take another vote. So there's basically at least 2, if not 3, levels of voting.
Has anyone done that?
Yes. Yes.
So you can initiate women?
No.
What happened?
They said no.
Who? I know. Yeah, they didn't know. Where was it?
They mean, 3 people said no in the GBC.
Yes.
Probably like sannyasi.
Yes.
What is the reason?
System. Okay, so the Shastric system is that the way you choose a guru is you examine a guru for a year, and the guru examines you for a year, and it's a personal choice. It doesn't. There's no voting, there's no... You won't find anything in Prabhupada's books where he says, you know, choose a guru because what we had there... Actually, I wanted to do that. It's one of my exercises I wanted to do today. Is to show what is the bona fide and what is the bogus guru. And there's never anything that says one of the qualifications for a bona fide guru is they have to get the votes of a council and they have to be on some, you know, approved list from some institution. So the original Shastric system is that you study the Shastra, you understand who is a guru, you take 1 year to examine the guru, preferably to live with the guru. It doesn't mean in the same room, but in the same village. You're living closely with the guru. The guru examines you for minimum a year, you examine the guru for minimum a year, and then you decide who you want to take initiation from. In our diksha lines, about 20% of the diksha gurus are women. In Bhakti Nortekra's diksha line, he comes from a diksha line from Janavamata, and between him and Janavamata are 3 women. Prabhupada specifically said, I want all my spiritual sons and daughters to initiate disciples. And many times he said, I want all my disciples, men and women, boys and girls, to become gurus. So that's...
Why didn't Prabhupada make any female gurus in his time?
Prabhupada didn't make anybody.
That's right.
So, yeah. So that's... Prabhupada didn't make anybody.
Oh, right.
Prabhupada asked everybody to become guru. Prabhupada said he wanted, you know, 10,000 gurus. There's 7 billion people on the planet. I think we need more than 80 gurus. If you only have 80 gurus, then, you know, some people end up having to take a lot of disciples who they can't really train, and they end up, people end up getting trained by the shiksha gurus instead. Okay. Please try to ask me questions more just on that. Which way?
Yes,
it is where. Can you show me? I thought I marked them once again.
This one?
Yeah. Oh, it's a big one. Oh, okay. What is the difference between piety? Oh, I did.
No, you touched on it.
I touched on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, piety, the difference between piety and agata sukriti. Piety is something done with under the laws of karma to be a good person so you get a good body and you can go to the heavenly planets. When we say agata sukriti, although technically the word sukriti just means nice activities, and agata just means unknowing nice activities, but the way it's being used here is actually angas of bhakti, but not done with a consciousness of trying to please Krishna. It's kind of like pre-bhakti. This is very nicely explained in Bhagavad Gita chapter 12, text 10, where Krishna says, if you can't follow sadhana bhakti, anybody remember the beginning of sadhana bhakti is?
Practice.
No, the practice. Beginning of the practice? Oh, come on. What's the beginning? The beginning qualification is attraction, but the beginning practice.
Oh, thinking of Krishna.
Yes, thinking of Krishna. Thank you. So, Prabhupada said the beginning of the practice of sadhana bhakti, and that is not that after you're advanced you stop thinking of Krishna. But sadhana bhakti begins with thinking of Krishna. So, let's say you do some work for Krishna, but you're not thinking about Krishna. Like all this list of 64 items. If you're doing that without doing it to please Krishna, without thinking of Krishna, is it uttam bhakti? No, it's not. So, pure bhakti, sadhana bhakti, is when I'm doing them to please Krishna, I'm thinking of Krishna. That's the beginning, starting the process of pure bhakti. So one way that you can prepare for that is you can do the activities of bhakti without knowing why you're doing them. So you're not, it's not yet uttam bhakti. It's agyata sukriti. It's unknowing. So I come to the temple. I come to the temple because it's a neat looking building. And I have a flower in my hand and I just leave it on the altar. And I'm not thinking I'm giving this flower to Krishna. I come in the temple because, oh, it's an interesting building. I come as a tourist attraction. Everyone else is bowing down, so I bow down. Or like in our farm in Hungary, we have, I think, 30,000 tourists a year. And they're just, you know, regular European tourists. And they pay 5 euros each to take a tour of the temple. And part of their tour is they go in front of the deities and they chant Hare Krishna. And when I saw that, I walked past the temple and they're all holding hands, all these European tourists. I mean, just get your picture of the stereotype European tourist, and that's what they look like. And they're all holding hands and singing the Hare Krishna mantra and dancing in a circle. And I went to the temple president and I said, Prabhu, there's all these ordinary people in the temple room chanting Hare Krishna, singing. He said, yeah. I said, no, you don't understand. He said, yeah, this happens all day. So they're not chanting Hare Krishna because they want to bring pleasure to Krishna and they want to love Krishna. They're chanting Hare Krishna because they wanted an experience. I said, how do you get them to chant? They said, well, they paid 5 euros for the experience. So that's a gyata sukriti, but that's very different. Pious activities, you know, I plant trees, I dig wells, I open schools, I give money to poor people. Now, let's say I'm giving money to poor people, and one of the poor people I give money to is a Vaishnava. Then it becomes a gyata sukriti. So it's got to be actually bhakti. I mean, some things of bhakti might look the same. It's got to be bhakti. The devotees are distributing prasadam, and I help them distribute prasadam, that's a gyata sukriti. If someone's just distributing ordinary food and I help with that, that's pious activity. Is that clear? Okay. I don't think there's any other ones there. I'm going to go another, like, 3 minutes. If devotees of the temple you are serving at don't really want to follow Krishna's likes and dislikes when it comes to worship, is archana form because it's not so important to them. So I'm not really sure what that means. I mean, they want to dress Krishna in blue jeans? Or, I mean, what does that mean?
No, it means they don't want to follow, like, you know, like cleanliness standards or some of these things, that it, these rules that it says in here, they don't really follow
it. But it really bothers you and you're not really in a position to change anything. Well, this goes back to what I talked about before. You have to see what's my service, what's not my service. What, you know, even the psychologists talk about that. What's your area of influence, right? I mean, even the materialistic people, they say, what's your area of influence? If you can't change anything, then saying something about it is just disturbing, to at least to you in your spiritual life. And then you have to make a personal decision. Is this bugging me enough that I don't want to stay here? And wherever you go, there's going to be something that bugs you. Even if you live by yourself, something in yourself will bug you. Right? Yes? So, you know, you've got to make that decision. And it may not just be your decision. If you're married, it's also your husband's decision. If you have children, your decision will also involve them. If you have parents, it will also involve them, and so forth. It may not just be your decision. But wherever we are, this I will give you a guarantee in writing. Wherever you are, there'll be something going on that's not exactly according to the Nectar devotion. I'll promise you that. And I'll also promise you probably in your own life that's true too. You know, if any of you can tell me, I always follow every single thing that's here in the Nectar devotion every day, all day. You know, I'd be interested. Again, you know, am I perfect? We're very forgiving of our own imperfections, generally, unless we have some sort of psychological problem and we meditate on them all the time. But usually we overlook our faults and think, well, I'm trying. And so we have to think like that of others too.
But they're not trying.
How do we know that? I don't know that. You know, I've had people guess what my motives are and guess what my determination is, and sometimes they think I'm much more pure and much more selfless than I am. Anybody ever think you're better than you are? Yeah, and sometimes I think I'm much worse than I am. And I have a few good friends in the world who actually know who I am. And they don't think I'm great because of my good qualities, and they don't think I'm terrible because of my faults. And I can actually just be myself. I have maybe 4 or 5 people like that in the world. That they actually know me. They really know what my motives are. And they really know what my personality is, and they're willing to accept me for who I am. And everyone else thinks I'm either better or worse than I am in something. So, you know, if other people can't understand me, how do I know I understand others? And I don't really have to decide what other people's motives are, except I have to decide who I want to associate with. So I've got to decide who I want to associate with. And that's all. I don't need to decide past that. And all I can look at is people's behavior. I cannot judge people's motives unless they tell me and I believe them. Or unless you're a mystic yogi, and I know some.
So it's between them and Krishna.
It's between them and Krishna. Okay. And what's between you and Krishna is your service. What is my service? Am I doing my service first class? And my service might include correcting others. Like here, my service includes instructing you. But it only includes instructing you in this class. If I see any of you in the temple room and you're chanting shnik shnik shnam nam shnik shnik shnam, it's not my business anymore. That's not part of our contract. You follow? We do have a contract that if you choose to come in this room and sit there and I choose to sit here, that I can tell you heavy things. Have I said some heavy things in this room? Yes? First of all, I know if I'm talking to a group that probably won't be so offended because you'll figure I'm talking to somebody else. You'll probably figure it's not aimed at you. You can say much heavier things to a group than you can to a person. But I only have your permission to talk to you as a group. I do not have your permission to hit on any of you as individuals. And I don't have your permission to get on your case outside. As soon as we walk out of the room, even on a break, I don't have your permission to get on your case. And when the class is over, I don't have your permission to get on your case. We have a contract, and our contract has limits. And that's always true. And if you break those limits, it's actually one of the offenses on chanting. If you teach the glories of the Lord to the faithless, that's also one of the 64 items. You know, to say, to go beyond what somebody's willing to hear. So you have to see, do I have a contract with this person? Do we have an agreement that this person is willing to take correction from me? And that's not always just title. You know, I might have the title of being in charge, and maybe you're not going to willing to listen to me anyway, just because I have the title. And then I have to decide, do I want to give up the title, or do I want to ask you to leave the department? So to what extent you can correct other people depends on your relationship and your service. But please always remember how hard it is to correct ourselves. I don't know, maybe some of you have a much easier time correcting yourself than I do, but it can sometimes, for me, I've sometimes spent years correcting things and failed and failed and failed and failed and failed and failed and failed. I mean, like here it says, don't give pain to any other living entity. Are we all successful at that? That's hard. You know, we were talking about how hard it is not to blaspheme others and not to take pleasure in seeing them better than others. That's hard. Try doing it for a day. Try going for a day where you never say anything critical about anybody. Try going for a couple hours where you never think anything critical about anybody. That's not easy. Is it? Am I the only one with this problem? No, it's not easy. It's extremely hard. Burjan Prabhu talks about how he took a vow for Kartik once that he wasn't going to criticize anybody, and after 2 hours he gave up. No, it's not easy. So, and one can be trying to do that for years. One can spend 10, 15 years trying to be just a little humble or a little respectful or a little non-critical or something. Even sometimes with gross habits it's hard, isn't it? You may eat too much, you may eat the wrong kind of food or something, you know, or you may be chanting your rounds every day at 8 o'clock at night or something that you're struggling with. So let's not be too hard on other people. And if other people are under my authority and they're willing to listen, then that's something else. But you will not find the perfect place except Goloka Vrindavan. Not going to find it here. Avramabhuvanaloka. Doesn't matter if you go to the planet of Lord Brahma. You're going to find some things that are not favorable for Krishna consciousness. And then you've got to decide, what's the most favorable situation for me? And what am I willing to tolerate? There's always something you're going to be willing to tolerate. There's a book out now called Marry Him. And it's written by a woman who kept looking for the perfect man. And she ended up in her 40s unmarried. And she finally decided to have children just on her own through artificial insemination, which of course then made it harder for her to find a husband because now she has these two children. But she was writing that, you know, nowadays that women are thinking, let me find Mr. Perfect, let me find Mr. Perfect, let me find Mr. Perfect, let me find Mr. Perfect. And she said, first of all, they never think whether or not they're Miss Perfect. And she said, the older they get, the less likely they're going to find Mr. Perfect. And after a while, they get old enough that they think, you know, I'll practically go for anybody. She said, you know, just be aware that, you know, better to find Mr. Good Enough than to find Mr. Perfect. So it's going to be like that with anything. It's going to be like that with anything. The room you stay in, the person you marry, what you're given to eat, the devotee community you're part of. You know, find the good enough. You're not going to find the perfect. And if you try to force your material situation to be perfect, you'll just agitate a whole lot of people, mostly yourself. We see that with schools. You know, I run schools and now my daughter's teaching, and there's a tendency by the parents to want to make the school perfect. The parents will come and complain, you know, what about this, what about this, what about this? And you can't make the school perfect. You just can't. You can't make the temple perfect, you can't make the school perfect, you can't make the grounds perfect, you can't make your relationships perfect, you can't make yourself perfect, you just forget it. What you can do is you can devote everything to Krishna, and then you can be perfect in that way, but externally you're not going to make everything perfect. And you're not going to find a situation where you're not going to find the temple, I'll guarantee you, where every single person in that temple is on the platform of prema. And if they were and you're not, then they wouldn't let you in anyway. You know? You're just not going to find it. You're going to find it where there's all different grades of people, and one of them is you, and where you're probably driving other people as nuts as other people are driving you. You just don't know about it. Or they tell you and you brush it off, just like they brush you off, and you brush them off, and you don't realize you're brushing them off. Hey, you know, do you think you could do it? I mean, you know, you do this, and you go, yeah, 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 and you think, oh, it's not so important. Why are they picking on me? words, I'm going to other people and saying, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? When other people come to me and say, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? I may just think, oh, why are you criticizing me? So it's, you know, it's a line. Where is the line of blasphemy? Where is the line? But let's just try to be a servant and make Krishna happy and not try to fix, you know. Bhakti Sananda Sarasvati has a heavy essay about don't try to reform anybody but yourself through the holy name. Don't try to be a reformer of the world. Of course, when you reform yourself through the holy name, then you can be a reformer of the world. I mean, Jesus said the same thing. He said, why do you try to take the speck out of your brother's eye when you have a log in your own eye? He said, you hypocrite, get the log out of your own eye and then you can better see the speck that's in your brother's eye and take it out. So let's get our own house in order and let's just try to do our own service nicely. And it's hard. As I said, this is like practical humility 101. What I'm a servant and what's my service and what's not my service. It's not my service. It's not my service to go up to everybody in Mayapur and tell them what to do.
So if you live with people, you don't ask them to change?
You can ask them. If you ask someone to change that's not open to your asking them to change, it won't work. You'll just anger them. What do they say? Don't try to teach a pig to sing. So people have to be open. You have to have a relationship with them. They have to be open to hearing from you. If they're not open to hearing from you, it's actually you're committing an offense. Yes.
You know, like a busy. I live at a temple where there's both women and men ashram, and there's a lot of women. So sometimes we have some issues, and so we just like talk to the temple president and ask him to talk to the other people instead of us going directly. You know,
yeah.
That would just create.
Well, that's exactly. So if I don't have the relationship, if I want to say something to you, and I don't have the relationship with you, I can find someone who does have the relationship with you, and does have the contract with you. And suppose they say, well, I'm not going to do it. Then you either tolerate it or you go to their authority. And if they say, I'm not going to do it, you either tolerate it or you go to their authority and eventually you go to God. And you say, please, Krishna, fix this. And if he says no, then you say, okay, what do I need to fix in myself? You know, or you may say, I don't belong in this situation anymore. Okay, let's just take 10 minutes to 12:40. Thank you, Hare Krishna.